Well, I have to admit, it does seem a bit strange to be revisiting the birth of Jesus narratives on March 1st. But I understand from Reverend George that you are going to be studying all of Matthew during this Lenten time, and Matthew starts at the beginning. But beginnings are kind of interesting, aren't they? Because sometimes it's very hard to decide just where they start. And so Matthew starts with tracing Jesus' family back some 42 generations, or about 2,000 years, to Abraham. And that's a whopping genealogy in my mind. I watch Finding Your Roots sometimes, and if they get, you know, 400 or 500 years of history together for a person, they think they're doing mighty fine. Well, Matthew thinks it was important for us to know that Jesus' foster father, Joseph, was a descendant particularly of both Father Abraham and King David, both of whom were mentioned lots of times in the Bible as being connected to that line that would have the ancestors of the awaited Messiah. Well, you and I have roots, whether they are blood types or not. And sometimes we may think that that's just fine to have be related to so-and-so and so-and-so, but sometimes we may think maybe it's not quite so good. But most of the time, even though we may know quite a lot about our backgrounds, we don't know much. That doesn't mean that all of those persons who have come before us haven't had a whole lot of influence upon who we are, what talents we have, the opportunities we have may have had available, the difficulties we faced, and the worldviews that we now hold. It's good for us to recognize that none of us are self-made. There have always been building blocks of many, many kinds, which you and I have stepped upon. Well, after the genealogy, Matthew tells of Joseph then agonizing over what on earth to do when he learns that Mary is pregnant before they have been together. He thinks he's got it about right when he decides not to make a scandal of the situation, but to divorce her quietly. Still, he is willing to listen to a voice he knows is from God, which tells him that this child's conception is itself holy. It is of God, and Joseph is to go ahead with his plan to marry Mary, and that this son will be a most precious son for all. The ponderings for us in these passages. Well, I dare say that our lives may very well have been and are strewn with some complicated decisions too. And if you're like me, sometimes I may be really, really clear about what will definitely be a bad or wrong decision in some situation, but exactly what the best situation decision is, that may not always have that perfect clarity. Or I can see harm in any direction that I think of going. Or having discarded what I think are those very worst possibilities of action, I may not continue to seek more than just the next okay option that I think of. Then there are those other times when I'm not even aware that I've made a decision. I've just been going with the flow and taking the easy way out, really. You may have been there too. Times when we just go along with what we think our families or the group we're a part of would think is the way to handle something, instead of truly considering everything for ourselves. Joseph didn't act rashly. He waited. He slept on this very hard decision, both literally and figuratively. And he heard God's word on the subject, and then was willing to act upon it, so that he did not just choose a good enough decision. He chose the best and the holy decision, and therefore came to peace with it. Do you believe that there is always a holy decision in the mix of what you are currently facing? What do you do to listen for it? And will you trust in it? Trust that God, if you follow this decision that is God-led, God will always also lead you through all the things that come as a result of it. For God's decisions, following God doesn't mean we don't have problems, but God will always have light in the midst of it. The next part of the story is about the non-Jewish magi or astrologers who are seeing the extra bright star and then traveling several hundred miles as they follow it to worship the one predicted to be the Jews' King of Kings. This is from Matthew 2 now. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem village, Judah territory, a band of scholars arrived in Jerusalem from the east. They asked around, "Where can we find and pay homage to the newborn king of the Jews? We observed a star in the eastern sky that signals his birth, and we're on pilgrimage to worship him." They told him, "Bethlehem, Judah territory. The prophet Micah wrote it plainly." Again, the scholars set off. The star led them until it hovered over the place of the child. They could hardly contain themselves. They were in the right place. They had arrived at the right time. They entered the house and saw the child in the arms of Mary, his mother. Overcome, they bowed down, knelt, and worshipped him. Then they opened their luggage and presented gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Significance for us. First, there is an innate humility in bowing to another, isn't there? These men of learning, who were revered themselves in their own society, bowed down and even knelt before this foreign child. And get this, a baby even of another faith. I attend an interfaith prayer service for peace every New Year's Day at St. William's Catholic Church in Louisville. Interfaith meaning not all denominations, but all faiths. And this year I sat behind a row of head-shaved, saffron-garbed Buddhist monks. During the time when we had the passing of the peace, what we were invited to do was to do what is often done in the Eastern religions of having our hands together in prayer form near our hearts, bowing our heads and saying namaste. And then we take our hands and we point them toward the person that we are greeting. Namaste means, in some ways of translation, the divine in me acknowledges the divine in you. Well, I find that absolutely mind-blowing. I love that. And sometimes in church, that is what we do too. We may not say namaste, but we might say the divine in me acknowledges and respects the divine in you. What a peace-promoting kind of thought. You know, whether or not we're trying, we slide into a wide array of routines in our daily lives. We have morning routines. There are exercise routines for some of us. There are work, coffee, news, pill, phone, TV, and bedtime routines. There are church and devotional routines. And they can be very helpful. They kind of move the day along and us with it and make sure we don't forget things, and that can be helpful. But they also take the place of doing much thinking as we're doing these things. It's pretty easy then for that which is routine to lose its potency when it becomes commonplace, whether those are gestures or words in either the secular or the sacred contexts. For Christians, this gesture is not routine. And that might be the reason that it had such meaning and power for me. But I find that I need to be reminded, you may too, that I need to be reminded to humble myself before and respect and honor every single person I encounter, And yes, know that there is at least as much divine in them as there is in me. And I need to call upon both of those in both of us. First, the Magi bowed and perhaps even knelt. They humbled themselves, they gave of themselves, and then they presented the material gifts that had value to them. In this latter regard, I think of the dependency of all of our churches today still upon people seeing part of their worship as giving what is valuable to them, their time, talents, and treasure. I remember the first fruits practice of the ancient Israelites, giving the first fruits of their harvests to the priests as an offering to God. Not the leftovers or the scrawny pieces, but the most anticipated, the most valued part of what they had. I think all of these passages, the genealogy, the birth of Christ, and the worship of the Magi, are all actually worshiping God passages. We started with that genealogy, which among the many relatives listed included a number who passed down their very, very living faith, teaching their offspring all the time about the God who led, the God who cared, the God who never left them, even in the midst of the greatest of their trials. Thinking about God is worship, isn't it? Joseph, who followed the word God spoke to him, however inconvenient and unheard of that action might have been. Is that not worship? The Magi, scholars, humbling themselves before a foreigner's baby in whom they saw God. Worship. Sometimes we think worship needs to be in a very particular way, though, and feel something is wrong if it varies much from that standard. But I was very impressed when I came in today, let me tell you. I was expecting the organ over there. What happened? You have been changing. There's a story I just love. Some of you may be familiar with it. It's called The Fourth Wise Man. It's by Henry Van Dyke. And he talks about a man who also thought that worship had to be in a particular way. I have condensed this in all kinds of ways. This is not really the story he told. It's what I've done with it. I'm just telling you. Okay. So he envisions that there was a fourth wise man, and he names him Artaban. And Artaban is supposed to meet up with those other three wise men that we normally think about. And they're all going to follow that brightest new star to wherever the star takes them, to this newborn king, because they are followers of Zoroaster, who says that, you know, the stars have a lot of knowledge for us and that they can tell you a lot of things. Well, they knew that that star, when it came, was supposed to lead to, was be the king of the Jews. And so they all decide to get ready, and then they're going to meet up together and journey the rest of the way. Well, Artaban decides that he needs to sell his house first, and then he buys these three jewels. And one is an emerald, and one is a ruby, and one's a pearl. And so then when he sets off, though, he thinks he may not be able to meet up with the others. And so he's really trying to get there as quickly as he can. But he finds that when he is journeying on his own, he finds a gravely sick man that's lying on the road, and he stops for many hours to try to nurse him back to some health. And indeed, he does miss those friends that have gone on before him. So he sells his emerald and purchases supplies and then sets off across the desert. He follows still that bright star until it shines above the village of Bethlehem. And he draws near the village full of hope, for now at last he can give his pearl and his ruby to the king. But the streets are deserted when he gets there. And at the door of one of the stone cottages, he sees a young woman clutching tightly to her own child. He inquires of her about his three companions and the newborn king. And she says, yes, there were three strangers that came by, and they did worship, and they had gifts to bring. But then what happened was that Joseph and his wife Mary and that new baby went off to Egypt because they were afraid that the Herod's soldiers were going to kill him. And now the townspeople say that Herod's soldiers are coming to kill all of their children. Indeed, when they look out, they can see Herod's soldiers that are right on the edge of town, and there is pandemonium everywhere. There's a clashing of swords, howling of terror, and the wailing of irreparable anguish. The terrified young woman shrinks back into her cottage as far as she can get into the darkest corner, covering her own baby with her robe. And Artaban, finding courage, stands in the doorway. When the soldiers reach the cottage, Artaban is blocking it, and he reaches out. He calls to the captain, and he says, "Here, I'm here alone. I don't have anything else to give you, but would you take this ruby and leave me alone?" So he holds the ruby out, the captain takes it, and he tells his soldiers to move on. The captain's eyes widen and they leave, and then the woman's whispered cries of gratitude can be heard filling the small house as they've left, as she thanks God and prays for blessings upon this kindest of strangers. Artaban, however, is conflicted. His prayer is more for forgiveness. O God of truth, forgive my lie. I have said the thing that is not to save the life of a child. And now two of my gifts are gone. Shall I ever see and worship the King of Kings? By now the star has vanished from the night sky, and Artaban has no idea where to go to try to find this child. So he seeks out a rabbi for some guidance. My son, our scriptures foretold that the King of Kings would be despised and rejected. It is not likely that he will be found in a palace or among the rich and the powerful. If you seek him, look among the poor and lowly, the sorrowful and the sick. So the years pass, and Artaban travels onward, always searching in the poorest places for the family from Bethlehem. And though he finds no King of Kings to worship, he does find many people to help. Wherever he goes, he shares his food and clothing with the hungry and the naked. He does what he can to help the sick, and he visits those in prison. His years, decades actually, go by more swiftly than a weaver's shuttle. Then finally, he thinks he finally is very close to finding his king in Jerusalem, and maybe even helping him, for he hears about a man about to be crucified because the authorities are concerned that he is too powerful and the people call him the Son of God. On his way, however, a young girl is being dragged off by soldiers. She struggles free and flies toward Artaban, falling at his feet in the street and pleading with him to help her. She has recently been orphaned and is about to be taken into slavery because she cannot pay her debts. He decides he really has no choice. So Artaban takes his last gem, the pearl, from its pouch and places it in the girl's hand. Here is your ransom, daughter. Soon after, Artaban is killed by a heavy roof tile hitting his head during the earthquake after Jesus' crucifixion. Yet he seemed at peace. During his lifetime, do you think Artaban did worship and bow down in honor to the King of Kings? Did he give him his treasure? What does worship mean to you? And how will your life be measured? Amen.